Well, it certainly is encouraging for us to have this number present for our Friday evening service here at the end of this week of special services. We're glad that we can be assembled together tonight. I'll just bet you the promoters who put together the Sugarland concert didn't think about the fact that there'd be a gospel meeting here tonight and that people trying to get their concert wouldn't be able to get there because of the traffic coming to this gospel meeting. Glad to have you here, and thanks especially to those of you who are visiting with us. We've been just thrilled all week to have visitors at virtually every service from other congregations, and that means so much that you care enough to come and support this congregation and what it's tried to do this week. It is a wonderful thing to be a part of something that is much bigger than any of us individually and even much bigger than any of the local congregations of which we are a part. We are a part of a people, and it is a big people, more numerous even than those of us who live in the United States. There are brethren all over this world, and it's just a wonderful thing to have that relationship together in Christ. I appreciate so much the opportunity to be with you this week. It has been a real joy to me. I've been honored to be with you this week. I thank you so much for everything that you have done to help make this week what it has been. I've always been of the opinion that the speaker in a meeting is really somewhat of a small part in the effort that a congregation makes to do what it does over the course of a week to teach the gospel in its community. And it's been a pleasure to be with you here and what you've done this week. And I thank all of you who've done anything. And there are a lot of things that have to be done to prepare for a meeting and to do all of the things that have to be done as the week unfolds. And I thank you for that. If Skip and Carol Paquette were here tonight, I'd thank them for letting me stay in their house while they've been away. I met Skip and Carol many years ago up in New England, but I've not seen them since then. But I've enjoyed having their place to live this week, and thanks to the Mears for letting me use their truck this week. And thanks to all of you who have had me out for meals or have had me in your home. All of that has been extremely enjoyable. It'll be hard to go back to real life next week and remember what the real world is like. But thank you so much. It has been a true joy for me to see Mark and Bonnie again and to meet their kids. That's how long it has been since I've been with either of them. I had not known their children. And so what a thrill it has been to get reconnected with the Copeland family here. And I know that you enjoy working with them and appreciate the work that they do. As I said the other night, not anybody among those who preach the gospel that I love and respect and admire any more than Mark. I just started to say I stand in admiration, but more like awe of what he does. He just is a tireless worker and teacher and preparer of things that other people can use in teaching the gospel. And I've enjoyed every minute of the time that he and I have had together this week. Certainly, if you ever have occasion to be through Nashville, Tennessee, give me a call. I would love to have you. I don't live very far off of Interstate 65 as it goes up through the north part of Nashville, and would love to have you anytime. Show you a little bit of Tennessee hospitality and try to return some of this goodness that you've showed to me. Please keep me in your prayers. My work continues in various places. Most of what I do anymore is on the road. As a single man whose kids are now away from home, I suppose the Lord has decided that the best thing I can do is just travel. I'm a little bit more portable than a married man would be, and so I'm able to travel somewhat more easily. But that involves a lot of plane rides and miles on the highway and dangerous things are out there, and so I hope that you'll pray for me in my work that I might have safe travel here and there and be able to do the things that I enjoy doing so much. And I certainly will remember you in my prayers as your work in the Lord continues here. I wish you nothing but the very best in all that it's obvious you're trying to do in this community to spread the gospel. Well, we've been looking at Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6 throughout this entire week. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him, For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. During our lessons this week, we've looked at every key term in that passage. We talked about the faith that is necessary for us to please God, and the possibility that we can please him by faith. We talked about the importance of believing that God is, and the reward that he has for those who will diligently seek him. Our last lesson here tonight, we want to talk about motives. I put this lesson last deliberately because I think this is the thought that I want to leave on your minds. Very important for us to address the issue of why we do anything that we do, especially something as important as seeking the Lord. And so I want us to return to this idea of rightly relating ourselves to the Lord's glory. Excuse me. It would be hard, wouldn't it, to overemphasize the importance of our motives. Why you do something, and as I say that, I'm reminded that I've moved to Tennessee and I'm saying why now instead of why, as I used to say in Indiana. Why we do something is of very, very great importance. Keith Yamashita, who is not a religious teacher, he is a business consultant, but he says very perceptive things about how to improve businesses and organizations and all of that. And he said all meaningful change starts with right aspiration. And I believe he's exactly right. If you want to change the corporate culture of an organization, or you want to change a community or a nation or a congregation or an individual's spiritual life, you'll have to do that primarily by getting people to aspire to things higher than what they've been aspiring to. You'll have to get them to elevate even their concept of what it is that they're seeking or trying to do. I believe motive is the key to motivation. That's not just double talk. Motivation means the effort that you put into something. And we've been trying this week to get us to be more motivated to seek God. Well, the way you do that is to work on the motives for which somebody does seek God. If you can improve somebody's motives, and by that I mean increase the quality of their motives, then there'll be more quantity of their motivation. So we apply that now to our subject of seeking God. What are the motives that ought to move us toward God? And why should we do this thing that we've been talking about all week in seeking God? Well, let's come at it this way. Let's ask the question, what is wrong with religion as most people practice it? You could, if you wanted to make a list of wrong things that people do in the religious world, you could make a long list of specifics. But if you tried to boil all that down to its basic essential, what would you say is wrong with the basic way most people approach that whole subject of religion? Well, here's what I would say. I would say that most people's approach to religion is self-centered. It has to do more with them and with what they want than it does with God. And that's extremely ironic, isn't it? That you could take a subject like religion, which you would think if ever there were going to be something that would get you out of yourself and get you concerned about something besides yourself, that people can take even that and make it about them. But I believe, as we'll see in just a minute, that's exactly what many people do, and maybe we might be among some of those very people who take, despite what we think, what amounts to a self-centered approach to seeking God. You remember Jesus said in John 6, verses 26 and 27, when the multitudes came back after he had fed the 5,000 the previous day. You just turn back there. I want you to notice something interesting about what Jesus said when they came back looking for some more loaves and fishes. I know it wasn't catfish, but it was probably good, you know, what the Lord made for them that day would have been delicious, and they certainly should have enjoyed it and been thankful for it. But when they came back the next day, John 6 and verse 26, Jesus answered them and said, "Most assuredly I say to you, you seek me." Well, that's what we're wanting, isn't it? For people to seek the Lord. But he says, "You seek me, not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him." Jesus wanted these people to understand that what they were looking for was more food, that he had some things better for them than that physical food. He wanted them to lift their vision just a little bit and to aspire to something more than those loaves and the fishes that they had the previous day. And that's not at all to diminish the importance of those loaves and fishes. The Lord provided them. It would have been good. They should have been grateful for them. But he's trying to elevate their aspiration. He's trying to get them to see that there's more that they could want than just the loaves and the fishes. So Jesus is working on their motivation, isn't he? He wants them to seek him, but he wants them to seek him for higher reasons than the reasons that they apparently were seeking him. Well, we might say, how silly that those folks would just come to the Lord for loaves and fishes. But sometimes we don't do much better than that. Because we do the same thing they did. They came to the Lord looking for what they could get out of him. And we do basically the same thing ourselves, don't we? We may want higher blessings than what they wanted. If we come looking for even spiritual loaves and the fishes, and we come because that's what we want, and it's about us, and we come looking for what Jesus can do for us that we want to have done, then I think Jesus would try to get us to see that there are higher reasons for seeking the Lord than that. Most of us listen to spiritually to station WIFM. What's in it for me? That's what we want from God. What we want. And people want all different kinds of things. Some people want to be happier. Some people want to have more peace of mind. Some people want to have happier family lives. Some people want to go to heaven. The people basically come to God with self-centered motives in which there's something they want from God, and that's why they're coming. And if there would be some suggestion that they might not get what they think they come to God to get, then they would have no more use for it. Because they're interested in what's in it for them. We tend to be more interested, you're listening? We tend to be more interested in God's blessings than in God himself. We want to know what we can get out of him. And some people want nobler things than others from the Lord, but you can go however high on the scale of nobility you want, and if it's still about what you want from God, then we're not doing as well as we might do. Some of us have a kind of a utilitarian approach to God. Utilitarian, utility means usefulness. And so we want to know how useful God can be to us. What can he do for me? We tend to look at God as in kind of a way similar to what I saw advertised several years ago on the internet that was called a voodoo machine. Boy, don't you get some wonderful things by email. Isn't email just a thing of wonder? This was an internet advertisement for this voodoo machine. It said, experience feelings of inebriation, psychedelic visuals, extreme relaxation, floating sensations, intense endorphin releases. Boy, we want those, don't we? All culminating in a relaxed, yet alert, euphoric state. It's a completely electronic, drug-like experience, and it's entirely safe, legal, and beneficial. See that? Beneficial in so many fantastic ways. A non-addictive narcotic substitute, relaxation and relief from stress, relieve depression and anxiety, and fight insomnia. All for, I think, $19.95. Just plug it in and look at all the benefits that you get. Now, That sounds kind of silly, but let's be honest. Isn't that basically what we want God to do for us? Don't we really think of Him as a glorified voodoo machine? You know, we want relaxation. We want some relief from our stress. We don't want to be depressed or anxious. We want to sleep at night. And if God can help us have those things, then that's what we want. Meister Eckhart, a writer from several centuries ago, said some people want to see God with their eyes as they see a cow, to love Him as they love their cow, for the milk and the cheese and the profit that it brings them. This is how it is, he said, with people who love God for the sake of outward wealth or inward comfort. Now, Meister Eckhart lived a long time ago when people had cows for their milk and cheese. We don't have to worry about that anymore. You know, we can get that at Publix. But we want that inward comfort, don't we? And so if God is a glorified cow from which we can get the milk and cheese of inward comfort, then that's why we come to Him. But listen to me. We're talking about motivation tonight, and we want to be more strongly motivated to seek God. I'm saying to you that self-centered motives are not strong enough to get the job done, no matter how noble they are. Now, to say that something is self-centered is not necessarily to say that it's evil. There are many, many worthy things that we want and even need for ourselves. And as long as the thing itself is not evil, it's not wrong to want something that you need or you want. Some self-centered motives are higher up on the scale of nobility than others. And, there are things, the higher things that we could want from the Lord than the lowest in ambitions. But still, the principle is the same. No matter how high up the scale of nobility you go in terms of what you want from the Lord, if that's all you want, just what you can get out of Him, if it's about you rather than Him, then not only is that wrong, what I'm saying to you tonight is those motives, because they're self-centered, are not nearly as strong as the motivation you're going to need to have to keep going over the long haul and to deal with what the devil is going to throw at you and finally get to heaven. We want to strengthen the amount of our motivation to seek God. We need to elevate our aspiration. We need to seek God for higher reasons than we sometimes do. And I don't think there's anybody in the room tonight who couldn't learn to seek God for a higher reason than the one that you've been seeking Him for up to now. We can always elevate the quality of what it is that we are seeking. So, what is the right reason for seeking God? Well, remember, motive is the key to motivation. We want more quantity of motivation, then we're going to have a higher quality, better reasons for doing that. So what would be the highest, the purest, and therefore the most powerful reason for seeking God? Well, I didn't have to come off all the way down here from Nashville, Tennessee to tell you what it is. You already know what it is, don't you? A sincere, pure, unselfish love for God Himself. That's what it is. Jesus was asked in Matthew 22, what was the most important and fundamental commandment in the law of Moses? He answered unhesitatingly that it was the command, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Well, all of us have known for a long time that that's the heart of the matter. You know, loving God is not all there is to serving God, but Jesus understood that that's the heart of the matter. That's the prime ingredient. That's the yeast that makes the thing rise. And so we've understood that. We've taught that. We understand what Paul said about that in 1 Corinthians 13, that if you leave that out, then you don't have anything if you leave that out, because that's the heart of the matter. So somebody says, so what are you saying tonight, Brother Henry? If you come here just to tell us something that we've known that simply for all this time? Well, the difficulty about loving God and that being the reason why we seek God is to work on it being a pure, unselfish love for God Himself.
for us to love Him for His sake. Regardless of what that might mean for you and me. We understand, don't we, in terms of human relationships, the importance of unconditional love. If there's a time and a place to love somebody because they are worthy to be loved, whether it pays you to do that or not. I preached this lesson several years ago in a place where, at that time, I was doing these lessons in a little bit of a different order than I do them now. So I had already preached this lesson. And so I was in somebody's home the next night for supper. And the husband just attacked me at the supper table over this lesson. He said, "Gary, that is just silly." He said, "Why would we need to pay any attention to God if there's nothing in it for us?" And I looked at his watch. And I said, "Does he love you that way too?" If you were in a car wreck and became a quadriplegic, and you could never ever again do anything for him, there's nothing in it for him, would he walk away from you? And the look she gave me, I strongly suspected that she thought that's probably what would happen. This man didn't have a concept of any kind of love except the kind of love that pays you. You're not getting from it what you think you want, and there's no reason to continue to love somebody. So we understand in terms of husbands loving their wives and wives loving their husbands and parents loving their children and all of that, and even loving our next door neighbor, that love is a much bigger thing than whether it pays us, whether somebody is of service to us, whether there's some utilitarian reason for us to love them, that there's a time and a place to love somebody because they are worthy to be loved. Even if it costs us greatly. Even if it might be very painful to show love to them. And there's a time to love because of love. A time to love because of the worthiness of somebody to be loved. It doesn't matter whether we get anything out of it other than the sheer joy of doing that which is right to do. Why do we have such a hard time applying that to God? I don't know. I read a book several years ago written by a lady who had apparently been through a lot of hardship in her life, and she had written this book about how to deal with hardship, and she had some very good thoughts. But she was very frank and honest to say that during the horrible days of her trials and tribulations, she would pray to God and beg God to remove this hardship, to solve these problems, and let this pain go away, and God didn't do it. And she was frankly put out with God. And she said, and I quote, "If God doesn't help us with our problems, what good is God?" Well, we maybe wouldn't put it quite so bluntly, but we may not think on a much higher level than that. We kind of think that that's why God exists, to solve our problems for us, to make us happy. He's a kind of a celestial Santa Claus to give us what we want, and if he doesn't do that, what good is he? That's why he's there, to help us and to do what we want to have done. He's the voodoo machine to help us sleep at night and to make our depression and our anxiety to go away. But listen to me, folks. Religion is not about us. It's about God. If we take a self-centered approach to seeking God, we're going to fall short of the goal. Whatever else is wrong with a self-seeking approach to God, it's not powerful enough to keep you going. It doesn't have enough strength of integrity to it to keep you going over the long haul. Religion is not about us. It is about God. Now, it's not either or. I didn't say it wasn't about us at all, but it's not primarily about us. Are there benefits that come to us from rightly relating ourselves to God's glory? Yes, indeed. And you're not any more grateful for those than I am. But those are secondary. That can't be the main thing that we're in it for. Those things need to be just the natural outgrowth of putting our emphasis upon something much more important than what we're getting out of it, and that is
loving God because He is God and He is worthy to be loved. And it is right. It is inherent in the creator-creature relationship for the creature to seek the Creator diligently. When we do that, then we do find all kinds of good things coming our way, but we find them coming just as benefits, as side benefits, as we pay our attention to something else.
So I repeat, religion is not about us, it is about God. We must learn to love Him unconditionally. We need to be sure, we've been talking about seeking God this week. Let's be honest.
Is it God that we seek? Or, truth to tell, is it not sometimes not God that we seek, but a particular path to God that might seem pretty pleasant to us to follow? But if the path turns out to be different, we might not be sure whether we would be seeking God at all. That might not have been really what we were in it for. We were in it for that particular path that we thought was going to be pretty good. How did you think it was going to go when you became a Christian? Now, who studied the gospel with you or taught you? Did they talk to you about what it was going to be like to be a Christian? Did they try to persuade you to become a Christian based upon the fact that they said, here's the kind of life that a Christian will have, and then at the end of it, there's going to be heaven. But this will be much better than what you have right now. So you had this scenario in your mind of what it's going to be like to be a Christian. If you thought that's better than what I've got right now, so I'll switch because I want this more than what I have right now. This is better. But then what usually happens? Has it turned out like you thought it was going to turn out? Is the path that you're on now, if you've been a Christian any length of time, is it where you thought you'd be at this point? Sure not for me, I'll tell you that. There are many days when I just honestly have to say to the Lord, this isn't what I had in mind. This hurts. This is hard. This is lonely. This is not what I bargained for. The path is very different than this path that I envisioned would be between me and heaven. I expect on those days when I get in that kind of irritable mood with the Lord about that, and I pray to Him honestly about that, the Lord could speak to me directly. He would probably say, Gary, what are you in it for? Were you looking for a particular path, and now that the path is different, you're not sure you want to stay with me? Or were you seeking me unconditionally by any path? That's what we ought to be able to say. Our commitment to the Lord ought to be to seek Him, period, unconditionally, by any path, at any price, by any sacrifice, be the path pleasant or unpleasant, painful or pain-free, easy, difficult. Lots of people know us or nobody knows us. Lots of people honor us or lots of people despise us. None of that really ought to be of any great consequence if it's God that we're seeking. The details won't matter too much. We'll have a preference over the path and over the scenario, but we'd be like Paul, and that is we'd keep going. If the path changed and ended up being very different than what we thought, we wouldn't keep seeking God because it was God we were seeking. We're willing to... You think when Abraham got up the morning, the Lord said, Abraham, you've lived here in Ur all your life, and I know you like it here, but you're never going to live here ever again. And we're going somewhere where you don't know anybody, and you will live there the rest of your life. Abraham might have said, Lord, you have blessed me with a home and a family, and I like this. This is why I seek you. And the Lord said, you need to seek me and let me determine the path. It may be very different than what you had in mind. But if you're seeking me, you'll be honored to come to where I am by any path. It won't matter.
C.S. Lewis once said,
if you're trying to get to some place that you desperately want to go to and need to get to, and somebody describes how to get there, and you're going there, and it's pretty ugly scenery along the way, you don't worry about that, because you're going where you want to be going. And the question is not, is the road pleasant or is the road pretty? It's, is this the right road? Would this road get us to God?
That's what it's about. So we must seek God for His sake and not for ours. When Jesus said in Matthew 6 and verse 33, not to worry about where our food and clothing and shelter and all that's going to be, seek first God, His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. In context, Jesus was talking about material things. Put the Lord first, He'll take care of your food and clothing and shelter. That same principle will apply even to spiritual blessings. What you want is God's rule. I think in context, that's what He's talking about when He used the word kingdom. You seek first God's rule, His sovereignty, His authority, His kingship, and His righteousness, and everything else will take its rightful place in due course, spiritual and physical. You'll get what you need, and much of it will be very enjoyable. But you seek God first, His kingdom and His righteousness, and don't worry about anything else. All of that will be well enough in its time. But if you had to do without all of those preliminaries, having God would be worth it, wouldn't it? If God would say to you when you became a Christian, now, between now and the time you behold my face in heaven, you are never going to have a moment of happiness. It's going to be hardship and pain and suffering, and they're going to put you to death because you love me. A right-thinking person would say, that's fine as long as I behold your face at the end. Because that's what I want. And not any of these other things. Have you ever considered the fact that while there are a lot of temporal blessings that come to some Christians, heaven is the only thing that the Lord promises to all of His people. Let's say there are 1,000 different blessings that you could possibly enjoy in this world as a child of God. Not everybody's going to get all of them. You get some of them. I'll get some. Maybe we'll get some of the same ones, but there'll be some you have that I don't have. Heaven is the only thing that God ever promised to all of His people. And happiness in this world is a lot like being good looking, you know? It's nice if you have it, but you can live without it. And a lot of people have to. Okay? So, what's this about? It's about God. We seek Him for His sake and not for ours. Because it's the right thing to do. Because what we want, above all, at any price to ourselves, is to rightly relate ourselves to His glory. Now, when I said that the other night, you may not have unfolded and unpacked some of the implications of that, but let me explain one of them to you right now. If I honestly want, above all, for God to be glorified, think of what that means. That would mean that if ever after having sinned against God and deserving to be banished from Him forever, if I would stand before Him in the judgment day and He would say to me, Gary, it would more greatly serve my glory. A greater good would come from the sentence of death being carried out than from amnesty to be extended. I hope that I would be able to say, Thy will be done.
I only want that you would be glorified. Whatever that means for me.
You see how self-centered we can sometimes be. Even in a subject like religion, which you would think would be the most unself-centered subject in the world. Having a deeper desire for God Himself is what life is all about. So, Lord, help us honestly and purely and unselfishly to want to be rightly related to Your glory. Lord, just tell me where to stand in the group picture, and I will gratefully stand there if it redounds to Your glory. When we do that, all kinds of good things come from that, obviously, in the here and now and in the hereafter. But they only come when we don't pay attention to them. You're familiar with the word serendipity? Something you find when you're looking for something else? I found a DVD in the refrigerator not too long ago. If I had any doubt that I'm losing what little memory I ever had. You know, when I found that DVD in the refrigerator, I said, Gary, you're over the edge here. Well, I wasn't looking for that DVD. It had been lost for quite some time. I wasn't looking for it. I was looking for the milk. I found something while I was looking for something else. Are there great good things that will come to you from seeking God? Yes, there are, but you'll get them when you forget about whether you're getting them or not. You start seeking God, willing to go toward Him, whether you get these things or not. If you had to give up the whole world in order to have God, it'd be a bargain. So, Lord, help us to want only that You will be glorified. Quickly, what are some changes that we could make to apply these lessons this week? First of all, if this is about God, we're going to seek Him, we would do well to start spending more time every day thinking about God. So I don't know how much time you spend today thinking about God. I'm talking about tonight, but before you got here, how much time do you spend thinking about God? 5 minutes? Well, try for 6 minutes tomorrow. But try to spend that time thinking about God and not what you want from God. You may find it hard, if you've never practiced it, to think just purely about God. His goodness, His attributes, His glory, without attaching requests to it. But try. Practice the discipline of learning to focus yourself unselfishly, unself-centeredly on God Himself. And if you can't do that but for 30 seconds, then try for 35 seconds tomorrow. And we need to work on learning more real prayer, don't we? Certainly, if we're going to seek God, that's going to involve wanting to communicate with Him as much as we can. But very few of us pray long enough to ever get past the chit-chat with God. You know, the uncomfortable chit-chat that you engage in with somebody that you really don't know, maybe you really don't want to be around them too much, but you got to be around them for a little bit. Maybe you've got to be around them for a long time. You're locked into a room with them, let's say. I was locked into a car with a young lady many years ago that somebody had roped me into taking her back to college. I was going that way, and she was going that way, and somebody offered my services to take her to school on about a 12-hour car ride. Well, after about 5 minutes, you know, we talked about all the weather that you can talk about, and there was a couple of hours of just silence. But it was a long way to the destination, and we couldn't go anywhere. And so, would you believe that before the end of that car ride was over, we'd actually started communicating. Got past the chit-chat and the awkward silence, and we finally started communicating. We both, I think, learned some interesting things about the other person. You want interesting exercise? Take a day off from work, go to a state park, rent a cabin, lock yourself in the room to pray for 12 hours. And you're not going to come out of that room. You prayed for 12 hours.
It won't take you but a few minutes to exhaust the chit-chat that you normally engage in your prayer, and there may be a couple of hours of awkward silence where you can't think of anything else to say to God. But if you're going to have to be there for 12 hours, before the day is over, you will have started really communicating with God. And you'll have learned more about seeking Him than you knew at the beginning of the day. Learn to truly communicate with God, and not just engage in pleasantries with Him. And then as we study the Bible, we can work on rooting out more and more of the erroneous ideas about God that we have in our minds. That ought to be why we study the Bible. So we can learn to study the Bible for higher reasons. That is primarily to learn everything we can learn about the way God really is. And then what about our obedience? We stress the importance of that. Seeking God means a growth in our obedience, the desire to love and honor Him more and more every day. So we've got to be wanting to improve the quality of our obedience. But we're not going to do that unless we set some goals that will get us out of our ruts. How long has your level of obedience been stuck pretty much where it is right now? For a long time. Well, why not? Do some honest thinking about an area where you really need to be growing in the quality of your obedience, and set some specific goals about that for next week or next month or for the rest of how much of this year left. But set some specific goals. Pray to God about that and say, God, You being my helper, here's what I'm going to do in a better way than I've ever done it before. And then lastly, I would suggest that we need to begin to learn the principle of sacrifice to God. Learn the value of giving that which costs us. And quit giving, Lord, only that which costs us nothing, which is about all many of us ever do. When was the last time you gave the Lord something that cost you dear? My youngest son, Grant, gave up a thing a number of years ago. He was a sophomore in high school that was more costly than anything many people can imagine. Grant is an avid golfer. I mentioned that in another lesson. He gave up his sophomore year of high school. He gave up his golf letter in order to attend Wednesday night Bible study. Not an unusual Wednesday night, just an ordinary Wednesday night Bible study. He couldn't play the golf match that evening that he would have had to play to get his letter that year and still be at Bible study. So he walked off of the course and said, Coach, I can't play tonight. I've got to go to Bible school. You'd have to know how much he loved golf to know how costly a sacrifice that young man made that night. And I didn't even know about it. I didn't require him to do that. I didn't even talk to me. I found out about it late. He showed up at Bible study that night. And I found out that being there that night was a costly sacrifice for me. I learned a little bit about that just a couple of years ago when I took a vow several years after my wife left our family. I had put her away scripturally. I decided, for about half a dozen practical reasons, that it would be best for me just to commit myself never to remarry. Because I thought I had to, because I wanted to, and I thought that that would be the best thing to do. And so I put it in the form of a vow. I took a vow of celibacy that I would never remarry. An elder in the church where I was at the time said, Gary, that was stupid. He said, you're going to want to remarry one of these days. And I said, well, I reckon I know that. I want to right now. But I said, what are you saying? If it's something you ever thought you really would want for yourself, you certainly wouldn't give it to the Lord. You only want to give Him things that we're fairly sure we're never, ever going to want. Is that what we're saying? Or is there not a time and a place to give the Lord something that cuts deep? Something that you desperately want. Something that you hardly see that you can live without. I'll tell you, I love the Lord a lot more than I did before I made that sacrifice. And I'm not elevating that as some kind of example for you to think highly of me. I'm just illustrating the fact. We sometimes wonder why we don't love the Lord any more than we do. It's because we never serve Him out of anything more than just our convenience. The Lord requires something that really would teach us a love for Him. We tend to say, well, I can't afford that.
David said, came to that sacrifice that he needed to make, and the man who owned the property said, I'll give you the stuff to make the sacrifice. David said, I will not give the Lord that which costs me nothing. We need to learn to do that. If you want the single suggestion that I can make to you that'll cause the Lord to mean more to you than He does right now, look for something costly and voluntarily give it to the Lord. And let it be something that will threaten your very existence because you don't see how you can do without it. But you put yourself in His hands. You say, I will lovingly offer this as a sacrifice. A love offering, as they used to call it in the Old Testament. And I'll be content to do without this thing if I have to. It'll be enough that one day I'll look upon the Lord's face. Gratitude for grace is what makes seekers diligent. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 9 and 10, Paul said, I am the least of the apostles, who am not worthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God, I am what I am, and His grace toward me was not in vain. But I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God which was with me. If an argument could be made that Paul was the hardest working apostle, why was that so? Because he recognized that he was unworthier to be there than any of the rest of them. And he was working hard to say thank you. It's the point Jesus made in Luke chapter 7. He was in the home of Simon the Pharisee. And the immoral woman of the city was showing love and devotion to the Lord, crying upon His feet and drying His feet with the hair of her head. And Simon sniffed with self-righteous indignation that the Lord would even let such a woman touch him. And the Lord said to Simon, I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. What's the difference between Simon and that woman? The Lord saying, you know, she is a sinner. She has huge sins that I would forgive of her. And so because of all this that I've forgiven, she loves me a lot more than you do, Simon, because you're a good fellow and you don't have anything but small sins. No. The difference is not that he had little sins and she had big ones, but that she saw her sinfulness and he didn't see it. And that's why she loved her like he didn't. Because she saw the magnitude, the grace that it took for the Lord to let her approach Him. When you begin to see that and understand that you don't deserve to be here tonight, and I don't either, and we'll quit our whining about what we have to do and we'll start doing what that woman did. You wouldn't have to twist her arm to get her there every night of the gospel meeting, would you? It wasn't about obligation. It was about gratitude for grace. The Bible is a love story. If our lives are not being moved by love for God Himself, then we haven't really read the Bible. So my fervent prayer for you is twofold. Number one, that you start taking God more seriously. I hope that some of you will. I can't know. I've looked into some of your faces all week. The face is some evidence of what's going on the inside. But I can't know. Some of you have listened like you really do get it. And a tear has welled up in the corner of your eyes once in a while. And I think you see the point. Others of you have looked back at the clock and wondered when this is going to be over. So I don't know. But I'll tell you what. If we don't start taking God with more utter, radical seriousness, some of us are not going to make it. But more importantly, whatever for you is the next step you need to take. And that doesn't matter where you are. If you're way back here, there's a next step. If you're way over here, there's a next step. Whatever for you is the thing you know you need to do next and you've been putting it off, I pray that you'll do it. You can do it before you go to bed tonight. That would be ideal. But whatever it is, do it. I don't have to know about it. It really won't add to the good of what you will do, whether I know about it or not. But if there will be even one person in this congregation who would take the step next that they need to take, then it will have been worth everything we've tried to do this week. Well, that's all. And I hope that you have been at least refreshed, as I have been, to try to think about what this is about. To re-center ourselves in terms of what matters relatively more than other things that don't matter quite so much. And that we want to go to heaven and be with God more than we ever have before. I haven't done these lessons in a while. I used to do these lessons a good bit, but I've been working on this new book called Reaching Forward. I have a series of lessons on that, and that's what's been on my mind a great deal lately, just the last 3 years. You know, thinking nonstop about the matter of Philippians 3:13. Forgetting that which is behind. Reaching forward, that which is ahead. Press toward the goal. Prize of the upward call of God Christ Jesus. As Paul said, depart and be with Christ. It's far better. We better believe. May he hasten the day when we look upon his face. If we can help you in any way whatsoever tonight, obey the gospel. Our honor would be to encourage you and to assist you and to stand by you through whatever life may bring to you as a child of God. We can help you obey the gospel. Won't you come? We're standing in the same way.